Hi, my name is Jeff, and I hope this ages well.
Hey there. Welcome to I Hope This Ages Well, a podcast centered around capturing the stories of our most senior community members. I'm a stand-up comedian, so to make each episode a little fun, I'm going to be sharing jokes with the guests, and the guests will be sharing jokes with me. I'm your host, Gilberto Soto. Shall we get started? Yeah, let's go.
If you love music, just play music. Don't worry about all the aspirings and all the concept of competition, professionalism. Just enjoy music as it is.
I'm excited for you to meet Jeff, a World Instruments store owner in the heart of New York City. If you walk by in the mornings of a store, you'll often see him play guitar. It makes the morning so much better. His passion for music is truly inspiring, and he has these rock and roll stories. Well, you'll hear it. So without further ado, let's welcome Jeff. Where are we today? Do you want to tell the listeners?
Okay, we're at the Music Inn World Instruments on West 4th Street between 6th and 7th Avenues. We're a World Instruments store, and we have phonograph records from back old days when Edison was just making them all the way up to now.
And this is your store?
Yes, it's my store.
Really appreciate you doing this for us today.
Yeah.
And speaking with us. So tell me, how did you end up owning the store?
It's an interesting story. Back in 1967, I had a job at a discotheque called the Electric Circus, playing an electric sitar for opening acts like Sly and the Family Stone and Chambers Brothers and different bands. So somebody told me I could buy sitar strings at this store, the Music Inn, and I came over here. And the guy who owned the store said to me, "You could play a sitar. Would you be interested in working on Saturday afternoons until Christmas?" It was probably around October. And I said, okay. So I worked from Saturday afternoons to Christmas. And then a little bit past it, and then I went out to California and stayed in California for 9 more years. And then came back to New York again and had a job playing in Midtown. And I thought I'd come down and see if the store was here. Sure enough, not only was the store here, but the guy who owned it remembered me from 9 years earlier. And asked me the same question if I wanted to work on Saturdays till Christmas. So I took the job on Saturdays till Christmas. Eventually, I stayed and worked on Saturdays and Wednesdays, and then Saturdays, Mondays, and Wednesdays to give other guys who were working here a day off. I still was playing at night, but in the daytime, I could work here. It was good. I liked it. And fit my personality perfectly. Each time a guy would quit, I'd suggest that I took the duties of his job or her job. And then it was just down to me. Eventually, Gerald Halpern, the guy who owned the store, started to get Parkinson's and was not well. His wife had died and he was alone. And his Parkinson's, we started opening the store just a few hours in the afternoon. I'd go pick him up and bring him here, take him home. Then he couldn't even come in anymore. He just stayed home, and I started running the store. Then he became bedridden, and this guy who you can't see across the room started just taking him out in a wheelchair or whatever it needed for him to get outside. Then once he was just bedridden, I hired these young guys to work. And when he passed on, I inherited the store he left in his will for me because he had no children. It was interesting, though, because he had relatives that lived in Argentina.
Oh, wow.
Cousins. So it was required by the lawyer to get in touch with any relative.
Yeah.
That might be make a claim on his estate, the store primarily. And unfortunately, he didn't own the apartment he was in. And that was, they were glad to get him out because he had a rent controlled kind of rent. He had been in there for 40, 50 years, maybe more. So I've been here ever since. Now, the store has changed a lot since he was here.
How has it changed?
Well, originally it was all upstairs. There's two levels now, and there are many rooms in the back where we make instruments, where we repair instruments. We have storage space for all kinds of cases and all kinds of people's broken instruments that are just left here broken. It's a very vast space. It's twice as big as what you have seen with the upstairs and downstairs here. But eventually I put stairs in and made this part accessible, made the back accessible, and started making instruments with this partner who is now walking to the back to do some work.
And this is like a lively store. People are in and out all the time.
People hear noises
in the background. And I think that's great. How would you describe what type of instruments are here? Because this isn't just a regular like guitar shop or like drum shop. Yeah, I mean, it's everything. It's a world
music store.
Truly so world.
Instruments from every country in the world are here. It would be hard-pressed to think of a place that we don't have something.
How do you know about each instrument and how to make
It was just back in the day before the computer. Of course, you had to go to the library and you had to see how, but it was easy for me to understand how they worked.
Yeah.
What was the initial concept behind it? And then the woodworking or whatever other method was easy to surmise from taking a good look at it. It was a natural thing for me to be able to do. So in the beginning, I just started. When I first started working here, they had a guy who was a full-time repairman, would take everything to his house and repair it. But he mostly did guitars and banjos and string instruments, mandolins. But after he left and moved to California or something like that, and I was back from California, I started doing the repairs, and there were so many people would show up like, oh, I am from India and my sitar is broken. And I could say, oh, I could fix that or whatever it was. So eventually it just accumulated just about every instrument.
Sorry, I was going to say, to find that in the heart of West Village is quite rare.
Well, it's a long story. The West Village is a special place in America. It has an interesting story that the rest of the country doesn't quite have.
Which is?
Back in 1626, after a small colony of Dutch came and lived at the bottom of the island, this guy came and brought his black servant with him, and he left him here at the bottom of the island. And he eventually witnessed the slaughter of the Indians that lived on the island because they didn't understand the concept that they had presumably sold Manhattan. They just thought that you gave them a gift and they welcomed you. And that was the extent. It's an interesting story how this slave then ran away once he saw the slaughter of the Indians and was found by the Indians, who became very fond of him, thinking he was a white man's version of an albino.
Oh.
And they took him to their shaman, and the shaman taught him everything he knew. And their shaman was an albino, it was a pure white guy.
So let me ask you a question. What does music mean to you?
Music is just another level of vibration in the universe of all your events and all your life experiences. But it has a unique quality of revealing the ordered nature of existence that you don't get just by reading somebody's book about how they got fucked up, or maybe somebody had revenge or recompense for their bad deeds. But music shows some sort of order in nature right away. So, but it's just the same vibration that the universe is, just at a certain frequency. In life, surrendering to all the life around you is one yogic practice, but music is a lot easier for most people than just sitting and staring at the wall. Although people love to go watch the seashore and the birds and the water.
And you said
the naked girls.
And naked. And you said that you used to play in a band.
I played in a band, a few bands, a number of bands from when I was very young. When I first was 17 years old, I played in a bluegrass band that became very famous through metropolitan areas and down south, even among bluegrass aficionados. And we played with Bobby Darin, who was a famous pop singer of the day, and we recorded a record. We had somewhat of an interesting career. Myself, personally, I wasn't that much interested in bluegrass among all the musics in the world, but I went along with it and had a good time. Then a few years later, I was hired to play in rock bands, and because I was playing, I had a nice electric guitar.
Tell me, favorite gig that you ever played?
The favorite gig I ever had was playing for a private party where Elizabeth Taylor and the Italian director Fellini were guests of honor. It was at Liza Minnelli's house in Hollywood or Beverly Hills. And I played an Indian instrument called the sarod with a drummer, a tabla player, an Indian tabla player, and another guy was so concentrated that he could dance with bells on his ankles on a tightrope.
Wow. That sounds like an Elizabeth Taylor party.
Yeah, people were mesmerized by it, and we played the party. They loved it, and we were invited to stay the night. I was invited instead of going back to a motel, even though they provided one for us. So I slept on the couch with one of the serving girls, and in the morning at sunrise, we had sex on the floor. And then when we finished in exhaustion and sweat, she was sitting on the stairs with her husband and they started clapping. And I would say that was a party. I couldn't ask for a more favorite party. Yeah, so.
What year was this?
Oh, this would have been maybe 1973 or four, something like that. Oh. I don't know.
What advice do you have to any aspiring musicians now?
Aspiring musicians? If you love music, just play music. Don't worry about all the aspirings and all the concept of competition, professionalism. Just enjoy music as it is. If people flock to you because you have something to say, then consider a gift from creation and go with it. But other than that, the music is the gift itself. Don't cloud your mind with false idols.
What do you listen to now?
Everybody. I listen until I become impatient with their
music?
Message, yeah.
Got any favorites that you have in your rotation now?
No, I don't have favorites. But I have people, of course, that I listen to and enjoyed all through my life like anybody else. You know, how could you not let...
Yeah.
First guy I really liked was a guy named Reverend Gary Davis.
Okay.
I liked Woody Guthrie a lot in those early days. I like a lot of folk musicians at the time, and especially black blues musicians.
Yeah.
Then I, as I said, I listened to bluegrass because I was in a very successful bluegrass band, played Carnegie Hall.
And, you did? You played Carnegie Hall?
At 17 years old. Yep.
And how was that experience?
Well, it was kind of cool because the guitar player broke string on the first strum of his guitar. He was so nervous being in Carnegie Hall. So the whole band looked at me to talk to the audience while he got a string on his guitar. So I extemporated in front of a packed house, and it seemed that I was a funny guy. Oh. So there was a lot of laughter, but all I talked about was how big the fucking place was, and how, you know, what it felt like to be on the stage, having never been in the place, and then walking out, and then having to talk to the whole crowd because
this what guy's a dream, trying- no?
Yeah, well, I was awake.
What a... So, yeah, you were awake.
That was a fun experience. I suppose I was gifted with certain charms that helped me get this job in this store and ending up owning it. But that was destiny. It was like in the seed of the sperm of...
Do you still play instruments?
Yeah, I've been playing a lot of the instruments we've been making. This is a solid body.
Would you mind playing something now?
Oh, no, you're not going to get me playing now. You got to get me when I'm really in a different headspace for playing. I don't just turn it off.
Okay, no, I get that. As a creative, we can't just be all on all the time.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to help anymore.
Do you have a favorite instrument you're playing currently?
Well, lately is this orange Zarode here.
Did you make that?
Me and this guy, the big guy, Andy, who walked to the back, make these instruments. It was originally my idea, and Andy was a student of mine studying the Indian bansuri, a flute from India. And I was teaching him Indian classical music because I had studied it with some very noted Indian classical musicians at the time that first came here in the 60s. And I showed Andy this model I had made of an instrument, and he, having made some guitars when he was a teenager, jumped on it with me, came to the store, and we started making instruments. And we've been doing it for about 20 years now.
Amazing. So
maybe a little more.
Going back to Jerry, I noted that he was a friend of yours. You said, well, he was more like a father-son relationship.
Well, he was a funny guy. He was very cold, and he never opened up to anybody. He didn't talk too much to people. One of the few surprises when I was here is that Bob Dylan's wife came in, and the two of them talked for about an hour as if there was some... They had known each other before when Bob first started out, and so somehow they were friends. But besides that, I never saw him talk to anybody. He was very cold and isolated. He was one of that generation that was very heavily traumatized by World War II, especially Jewish guys who were born in the early 30s.
Yeah.
They just, at their growing up, they witnessed the Great Depression and the slaughter of all their relatives. His grandmother was killed in Poland. He told me a story once. It was hard to get it out of him, but he teared up about how his grandmother owned a very big dairy farm in Poland. She was a wealthy woman, and they kept saying, you should leave because the Nazis are coming. The Nazis are coming. And she said, ah, fuck Nazis. I don't care. I'm afraid of nobody.
Yeah.
And the Nazis drove up in a car. They got out. She came out, and the guy just pulled out a gun and shot her in the head. So that was that. And so that traumatized Jerry so much that he was very cold to the world.
I mean, understandably so about handling the trauma, but you said he's a funny guy.
Well, you know, after all these years of working for him and him being locked up inside in his own, you know, angst, that he became physically locked up. His body became paralyzed. But he found relief by being able to take a big crayon or chalk and write in a book this like concrete poetry. Like he'd just write a few words, but the way he would do it would be onomatopoetic imagery of what he was trying to say. And he got really inspired by it. And my friend here, who I guess he went upstairs, would take him in a wheelchair to Greenwich House Poetry. And he found a whole new rebirth in life. And he never came back to the store. He never came in. He never wanted to know anything. I just took care of the store and took care of him. And that was it.
And what does it mean to you that he left the store to you?
Well, it's on many levels. My first instinct is to think that it was in the Big Bang already, you know, and it couldn't have been any other way. But for me, this is the perfect expression of my life form, you know. My body is the store. And I come every day, 7 days a week. I'm married and I have a wife who works in a hospital that is mostly occupied by poor, poor people in the Bronx. And she goes and works every day and just all hours, just really loves working there.
So let's say someone's coming into the store and they're saying, and I don't know if this happens, but hey, I want to get a new instrument. I don't know what kind.
Oh, that's very common.
Then how do you walk them through that journey? How do you find the right one for them?
There is that thing as whether they conceive of playing music in a melodic way or a rhythmic way. How they are limiting themselves is obvious right in the beginning. Some people are not so sure. They want to get a percussion instrument, but that is melodic, like a steel drum or some of these things. That is, every case is a special case, but it's like running a... look, you can work at Macy's and you can sell makeup.
Yeah.
And you could flatter women about how good they look from the smell of their perfume to their eyeliner. Or you can just try to help people find their divinity that they are and act in that accordance. One thing will give you a salary. The other thing, you're just living on the edge. I think it's better to live on the edge. We're all moving to the edge anyway, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, look, I can relate to trying to live on the edge versus trying to live like in a consolidated box. I think I right now live in a consolidated box. It's not comforting the older I get. So how does someone live more towards the edge?
Well, you have to not be afraid losing your freedom and maintain the freedom and the dignity of how you behave. Often just selling somebody a piece of shit or something they don't need even is a questionable behavior. Our whole society is geared to a rat race concept. And that's not going to save the world. That's the old way when people... we're very separated by borders and ability to converse or communicate. They wrote letters and put them on boats. That's really good for countries and different languages. But we're moving into a world with a device, nothing more than a telephone. You can instantly talk and be translated to the language of somebody in any country in the world.
So there's always a connection.
And we are connected financially with them as well now because American dollar supremacy is no longer reigning. Our money is losing its value in terms of everybody else in the world. And we call it inflation as if we blame our leaders. It's the nature of the game. But we are also moving in a very optimistic way where there will be a world of a sort of ubiquity. Like an ant farm or something like that.
So you have a very positive outlook on the future.
Oh, I do. But you see, I'm not afraid of convulsion and trauma because I was born during World War II. But I was small enough to not have been totally traumatized. But I was wizened by the experience, thinking, well, that atom bomb, you know, that's about the end of like dropping bombs on people. I see it's not, but they do it in like a miniature
way.
Yeah, miniature killing, miniaturized killing.
And so
somebody's house.
Nowadays, like, what do you enjoy doing the most?
Oh, I enjoy coming here, meeting people, seeing people. I really enjoy seeing people. People are fascinating to me.
Yeah, when I first met you, you were outside just people watching with your coffee, going in the morning.
Well, you never know.
Never know what kind of connections you're going to make. So part of this podcast is too, we like to share jokes with one another. Something fun, something that makes people laugh. So I want to ask you, is there a funny story with Jerry that you want to share?
Well, I could tell lots of funny stories, but I'll avoid telling funny stories with Jerry. That's the funny thing. There are no funny stories. But I could tell lots of funny stories.
All right, tell me one.
Well, this is more an amusing story.
I love it.
So I'm walking down Fillmore Street in San Francisco, and that's a black neighborhood, and it's like, you know, 125th Street in Harlem during the Harlem days. That's that neighborhood. It's 1967, and a big black limo pulls up in front of where I just happened to be passing by at that moment. But the black Muslim temple, and out gets Muhammad Ali. This is 1967. They've stripped this championship. He's a conscientious objector and says he's a black Muslim. and has joined the church. And all these women come out in these African dashikis, beautifully dressed with flowers to greet him. And a crowd forms, a very large crowd. And he looks over the crowd and he sees the one white face.
You.
And he says, "Hey, you. Yeah, you, hippie. Yeah, you, hippie. Get over here, hippie." And then he turns to the whole crowd and he says, "I'm a hippie too. I walked across," he put his arm on my shoulder and he looked down at me, and I was much shorter than him. And he said, "I'm a hippie too." And I said, "Yeah, you are, Jim." And so it profoundly changed my life. I was living off of a woman who I had met the first day I arrived in San Francisco. I went to see a Grateful Dead concert. This band had hired me to come out to California. They gave me this pill, which was called LSD, and they took me to a Grateful Dead concert. But I wouldn't put on love beads. Well, I met a girl and had sex with her right on the floor. I could care less. I thought the Grateful Dead was a lousy band. They were all out of tune, and the singer was horrible. But she took me home, and I started crashing with her a lot, and I was able to quit the band because they weren't that good. I didn't like them. So I went to auditions for other bands and got in a couple other bands for a while until I found somebody I thought was pretty good. But after meeting Muhammad, I decided this was not a good thing to do. This guy was so noble at this time of his life. So I moved out from Marjorie, and I got a job as a babysitter for two little black girls for the secretary of the Oakland San Francisco Black Panthers. It was a very amusing story. I loved these two little girls. I would take them to Golden Gate Park, and I started playing a sitar. I bought a sitar in a store. Oddly enough, with the sitar, I was walking down Haight Street with the sitar, and I see a crowd of 1,000 people coming up Haight Street, all in the street itself. And who is leading them but George Harrison? Now, sitar is a very delicate instrument, and you don't want it to get banged around or jostled in a crowd, so I started to go the other way. But when George recognized me with the sitar, because nothing was really happening, he yelled out, "Hey, mate, what kind of sitar you got?" And I was, of course, turned around and, let's see it. And then we sat down on the curb and we played the sitar together a little bit. He was better than me, I would say, and he was very nice. He told me the difference between my sitar and his.
Yeah.
And it was understandable. He was much wealthier than I was.
Yeah.
That kind of influenced me. Then they had riots in Newark and L.A. The black people. And the Black Panthers that I was living with started planning a riot in San Francisco, and I decided I had to get out. So I took the sitar, and I ended up hitchhiking back to New York City.
You hitchhiked to New York City.
I hitchhiked to New York City. On the way, I met Chuck Berry, and it's an incredible story. I almost got killed in the desert by a crazy sheriff and his posse. It was quite an experience.
Talk about living in the edge. So actually, now I have to ask, I don't want to use the word settle down, but how did you end up marrying the woman you're with now?
The woman I'm with now is, I was playing uptown in a fancy place, and I was working here in the store a few days a week. And she came in as a customer and wanted to buy a kalimba, a thumb piano, and in those days it was made in South Africa by a company named Hugh Tracy. And I tried to pick her up, but she said, "Look, I gotta go, you know, I have a class, and I'm busy, and blah blah blah, and I just want to buy the thumb piano, please." And I said, "Oh, you're a little too fancy for the guy in the music store, huh?" So I kind of teased her, and she thought, "What a prick." Anyway, as fate would have it, that night I went to do my laundry, and there she was in the laundromat. So I used the ploy of, gee, you know, how much detergent do you put in? You know, like, help me, please, you know? And she felt sorry, so she got involved, and we talked, and eventually got married.
And how long has it been?
46 years.
Wow. Wow. Isn't it, now that I'm hearing all your stories, there's a common thread of how music has literally changed your life in all sorts of ways. Oh, you know,
music always was part of my life, but when I was a teenager, I thought I wanted to be a painter, an artist. Yeah. And I had amazing experiences working for painters and have always been very blessed in the way I followed the path of my life. There was a college called Cooper Union on the East Village that I went to when I was 18. And I went as an art major. And after a year, I thought, this is not for me. So I quit. But the day I quit, I was walking down the hallway to leave the building, and there was a bulletin board with Mr. Kelly looking for assistant.
Yeah.
Call 212. And so I called in, and Mr. Kelly answered the phone and said that he has never worked with anyone in his studio, but thanks for calling. He'd rather not hire anybody. So I asked him in the last second, are you Ellsworth Kelly by any chance? He was a very famous artist of the day. And he said, yes, I am, and said, thank you, and hung up. I immediately called him back and convinced him to have lunch with me. He had lunch with me, and he liked me, and he hired me. So I actually fulfilled what I needed in a fine art education just by getting paid and having a job and talking to him all day about art, and even painting part of his paintings with him. So that was a good opportunity. And then through him, I was able to go ask him to introduce me to any artist of the day I wanted to. That was what I was doing pretty much until I ended up going to California to play in this rock band. But I always played the guitar from the time I was 10, and I was, people always thought I was very good at it.
Wow.
So, but I didn't take it as a serious profession. I thought I was going to be a painter as an artist. That never really happened, but I do make comic books.
Oh, and comic now?
Now.
Oh. But
I don't draw them, as it turns out. They're drawn by a guy who is a black guy from Trinidad. His mother worked as a cleaning lady at the Javits Center. And he became a friend of my son's. And one day he showed me a drawing of my son standing on a pile of rubble. And I'm saying, you better clean this mess up before your mom gets home. So I thought it was clever, and I bought it. And he started bringing me drawings, and then I suggested he put them in sequence. So the clever lad did a comic book about my son called Kule, which is his name. Kule or Kulo, Can of Bliss or Cannibal. And it was about, you know, smoking marijuana as a young man and what can happen. Were they going to hell? Were they going to some... imagine heavenly realms. Who knows what they thought? But it was an interesting comic book.
Did your son like it?
He liked it enough. He didn't really care too much one way or another. He was just busy being himself at that age of like 19, 18. And I started making up stories for the comic books. So we did several stories. And the latest one we did was the 10 plagues of ancient Egypt in a contemporized fashion. And I gave it to people for free. Anybody who gives me their email address, I would send them the 10 comics. They come in 3 installments, 1 through 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And they're all short stories, but they all connect.
Well, hopefully you can share it with me. I'd love to read.
Yeah, I'll send it to you. You give me your email address when we finish. And then if you so choose, you can always put it on the podcast if people want to send me an email.
Definitely can.
I can, and
I hope one day I can actually also hear you play some guitar.
Oh, if you live in the neighborhood, you come around. I play in the mornings a lot. I spend several hours in the mornings.
Okay. So what are your plans for tomorrow?
Oh, tomorrow. I think something's happening tomorrow. What's happening? Oh, no. That doesn't mean anything. I'll be here tomorrow, I suppose.
Well, I don't want to spend more of your time. I know you're still running a business now, so I just want to say thank you so much for spending this time with me.
Yeah, thank you, and I wish you the best. And what was the phrase I had to say? I hope this lasts forever.
Yeah, I hope this lasts forever, too. All right, thank you.
What I find so fascinating about Jeff's story is how music really shaped all of his life and the people around him. I also found it so interesting that when I walked into a store, every employee there had like a sense of pride for what they were doing. They handled each piece of instrument with so much care and love. It was a treat. Thank you so much for listening. And as we keep growing this podcast, your support means everything. So if you can rate it, tell your friends, anything will really help. And I hope this age as well. Until next time.